This is an ABC Radio National podcast. For full details, abc.net.au/rn.
Hello, Natasha Mitchell, joining you for All in the Mind here on ABC Radio National. Great to have your ears. And we're with you and a live audience from this week's Australian Science Festival in Canberra. The hard topic for debate, what is the nature of belief? Is the human mind an organ that evolved to believe? Why do many of us believe in things we can't necessarily prove or even see? Fairies, goblins, God perhaps? Are some beliefs healthy, others pathological? And where does science and religion fit into this discussion? We bring you an excerpt today, but as a special treat, as well as the program, we've put the whole debate online as a downloadable MP3 file, including the provocative questions that came flying afterwards from the audience. The brave souls taking on the topic are Professor of Psychology Max Coltart, who's a cognitive scientist and scientific director of the Macquarie Centre for Cognitive Science at Macquarie University. He's co-editor of the book Pathologies of Belief. Margaret Wertheim, an award-winning Australian science writer based in LA, is author of Pythagoras' Trousers and The Pearly Gates of Cyberspace. Margaret's written and produced multiple TV documentaries, including Faith and Reason for PBS TV in the USA. And Reverend Dr. David Milliken, minister with the DY Uniting Church, is ex-head of ABC Religion, a theologian, filmmaker and cult buster. David has a book with publishers called Walking Backwards to Paradise, about his 25 years of dealing with extreme religious movements. So let's take it away. For each of you, is there anything you personally believe but you cannot prove? Can I start with Max?
Everything. But maybe you could formulate the question slightly differently. Is there anything I believe that I can't justify? I hope the answer is there isn't anything, but I'm sure there are some things that I don't know about that I believe. You can't prove things true for certain in science. Anybody can be wrong. You can make all kinds of mistakes. So that's why scientists would rather talk about the justification of a theory rather than proving a theory.
Well, we live in uncertain terrain then if we can prove nothing that we believe. What about you, Margaret?
I believe that we will never have a theory of everything, and that there has been, you know, so many claims over the last 10 or so years that we're on the verge of a theory of everything. And it seems to me that that's highly unlikely, because even a theory of the things that physicists claim would be encompassed in a theory of everything seems increasingly difficult. But to call anything a theory of everything just seems to me such a wildly overwrought claim that I don't think we will ever be there.
Well, Stephen Hawking thinks that once we have a theory of everything, we'll see the mind of God.
Yes, and that is the notion that we can somehow be godlike. And I suppose that as a former Catholic girl, I still hold to the view that there is a fundamental difference between man and God.
And woman, for that matter. Yeah. David Milliken, what about you? Is there anything that you believe but you cannot prove, and especially in your role as a Uniting Church minister, perhaps?
I'm a bit like Max, actually, but I would need to know what you mean by a proof. If you mean a sort of demonstration that is incontrovertible, that has a type of inevitability that cannot be denied, then I believe a number of things like that, but those things tend to be trivial. They tend to be things that have to do with analytical statements, you know, that like mathematics and the like. But the important things like, does my wife love me? I believe that to be true.
Do you have proof?
But I can't give a proof that is one of those proofs that exhausts any possibility of doubt. And I guess this is the nature of life itself. I mean, I believe the Swans will be in the grand final. You see? That's a more speculative sort of belief, I would guess. So what I'm saying is I think there's a lot of things I cannot prove in that sense. But if you're asking me, can I provide some sort of reason for the things I believe such that it gives some integrity to what I believe, then yes.
This leaves us with interesting terrain. Mm. Max, what does this say about the psychology of belief? I'm just fascinated that once we have
beliefs, we find them very hard to let go of. And in fact, if someone tries to extract them out of us, in a sense, it's an affront against our own identity and self.
Well, we form beliefs for at least two reasons. One is that they're inferences from experiences from everyday life. So we think so-and-so must be true because that would explain these various facts. And we probably like to think that's the only way we form beliefs. But there's another way in which all of us form beliefs, and that is we adopt a belief because it feels good and it might be completely untrue. And that might sound irrational, but if it makes you happy, why isn't it rational? And those are the kinds of beliefs that might be hiding in my unconscious somewhere that I couldn't justify if you forced me to actually make them explicit. But I'm sure all of us do this.
David, religious belief is only one kind of cluster of beliefs. People have beliefs about all sorts of things. Mm. And some of them are around the supernatural, things that they can't see or prove. I mean, why is it that we believe in, many of us believe in things that others find equally unbelievable? I mean, I was surprised, for example, to read that 72% of Americans reportedly believe in angels, for example.
You don't? Sorry.
I'm going to hold myself out of this one.
No, look, there is no accounting for the sort of absurdities that people will believe. And I guess the challenge that I've had to face over the years is coming to terms with the fact that these people are usually very nice people, strong people, well-educated people, people who take these beliefs on with a type of integrity and try and live them out. I can give you an example. I was talking to a friend of mine in Manly last week. She does New Age She's recently bought a vibrating machine from Russia where it sits in the middle of the room and you sit around it, and this exudes a type of vibe that does things to you. And she said to me last week, she said, David, I've had something very important happen to me. I've got to be open to this and I've now got to act on it. I said, what is it? What's happened? She said, well, I got the word very clearly last week that I'm going to be living until I'm 342.
Blimey. So,
now, she's married. She is a very strong, interesting person. Her husband's a general practitioner. She has a master's degree. And, in fact, my experience is that people who get into those sort of sometimes quite bizarre beliefs tend to be well-educated, strong, creative, interesting people. They're not weak and easily led, as is the normal misconception.
Because, of course, you've spent 25 years or so
delving
into cults.
I have.
When collective beliefs go astray, I mean, when collective's belief in effect become pathological.
It's actually a very elusive thing to know why it is that this happens. And most of the time over the last 20 years or so, I've been knocking back my presuppositions, actually, and discovering the difference between people in the midst of those groups and myself. It's not a qualitative sort of difference often. It's a difference of degree. I mean, I'm a Christian. I believe in a guy who survived death. A lot of my atheist friends think that that's a type of madness.
Clearly you don't think it is a type of madness.
No, I don't. No. If I can't justify or give reasons for the things I believe, then I have no right to believe. Reason and faith are bound together, and yet both of them are sort of imperialistic, and both wish to consume the other. But faith without reason ends up as superstition, and reason without faith becomes conformist, dull and uninteresting.
I'm interested, Margaret, in your journey over the last number of years, in delving into history, unravelling the relationship between science and religious belief. Your sense is that they haven't always been at crossed purposes in the way that we think that they're in conflict now.
Well, historically, the record is very clear that science and religion have not been in conflict with each other for most of Western history, indeed quite the opposite, that theological impulses were profoundly behind the scientific revolution. Why is it that the West developed this science to the point that it did? The Chinese, the Arabs, were much greater mathematicians than we were at certain points in history, yet they didn't go on to develop the scientific revolution. One of the reasons why the West did was because the whole idea of searching for laws of nature got allied with God, that God had written the book of the world in the language of mathematics. So to read that book was to essentially do a theological exercise. And all of the great practitioners of the scientific revolution were very clear in their own writings that that's what they believed they were doing. And it raises an issue that I think that you talked about before, which I think is very important, Natasha, that faith isn't just something that's about religious faith. Scientists too have faith. I mean, the whole idea that nature can be understood in terms of universal laws, that requires faith. Physics is premised on the idea that the laws that apply here on Earth also apply in Alpha Centauri and on the other side of the universe. We have a lot of evidence to suggest that that might be true, but it was an enormous act of faith to believe that in the first place, and it actually took the Western world several hundred years to come to believe something like that would be true at all. So faith is fundamental to the scientific enterprise too.
And leaps thereof. Max, do you think that science and religion are both systems of belief, in a sense, or is science something fundamentally different, as many would argue, especially scientists themselves?
Scientists would like to say that what's special about a scientific system of belief is this emphasis on justification. But you quoted the figure that 72% of Americans believe in angels. Well, there's some recent interesting work which goes like this. You survey all your colleagues in a psychology department and you say, think about all your colleagues. Are you a better than an average teacher compared to them? 85% of people say yes. There's something wrong there. The answer has to be 50%. So these are academics, not angel believers. Nevertheless, clearly they formed a belief, at least some of them, at least 35% of them, based on inadequate evidence. So there are these two kinds of beliefs, and you just need to think about, how did this belief arise? Why does the person believe this? And the answer isn't always just as an inference from what happens to them. There are motivational factors at work all the time.
And when we're weighing up risks in our own lives, you know, catching a plane versus crossing the road, we make all sorts of horrendous predictions for ourselves that are way off the mark. And that in a sense is tapping into our belief about personal risk, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely. So people with, say, obsessive compulsive disorder, I've had one person who, when she left the house, would always hop down the corridor on one foot because she believed if she didn't do that, somebody would break into the house when she was away. And so she always did this and nobody ever broke into the house. There you are.
So we look for justifications, yes, for our beliefs rather than the contrary.
That's right.
Ha, interesting. Well, what do you make, Max, of... There's been a whole swathe of books this year by scientists who are either on one side critiquing religion. So Richard Dawkins, author of The Selfish Gene, is about to put one out that is absolutely scathing. It's vitriolic. And on the other hand, the head of the Human Genome Project, Francis Collins, has put one out trying to reconcile his own faith with science and his scientific practice. How do you read the times?
Yes, well, I'm like Margaret. I used to be a Catholic and I was corrupted by the philosophers at Sydney University in 1957, which is what philosophers are supposed to do. How could I have ever believed that nonsense? My mother was very upset about this.
Mother was?
Yes. She said, I knew that would happen as soon as you went to university.
That's university for you.
Yes. But it's perfectly true that many famous scientists are religious. And I guess it might not be very comfortable to think about this, but if you think, well, I'm adopting scientific beliefs because I'm inferring these beliefs from the things I see around me because that's how science works, and I'm adopting religious beliefs because they make me feel good. And you'd be a very unhappy person if you went around saying, even if this belief makes me feel good, I'm not going to believe it unless I can justify it. That way lies unhappiness. So I think you can reconcile those two different sorts of beliefs because you're adopting them for different reasons.
Mm-hmm. Margaret, what's your take on it?
In America, where I live, this is a particularly contentious issue at the moment because there is so much forcefulness on the part of religious fundamentalists to have creationism or intelligent design, as it's now usually called, taught in schools. So this is, I think, prompted an enormous response on the part of a lot of scientists, and we have had a number of these books. The most famous one that's come out in America recently is a book called The End of Faith by Sam Harris, who's a neuroscientist. And like Dawkins, he believes that science will triumph over the next century and religion will be completely obliterated, and the sooner the better. And I think that those books are, in my view, simply escalating the tension between science and religion, because I think they're presenting a view to America which is a really dangerous one, that it's us or them. My own personal view is that that is doing far more harm than good, and that it's simply intensifying the view that's already on the religious right that science is their enemy.
Sam Harris, the young neuroscientist who has written The End of Faith, has said, "The perversity of religion is that it all allows sane people to believe the unbelievable en masse." Mm-hmm. I mean, he's certainly putting some flames out there.
Yes. One of the agendas of Sam Harris's book is to try to convince people that ethics and morality are not articulated by religion, and that, in fact, we need to study molecular biology and evolutionary and the evolutionary history of humans to tell us what ethics really is. And actually, I think it's that claim that in some sense is far more serious, a threat to religion, and that this is something that the religious right have always suspected is, as it were, a scientific agenda, and now it's out there in the open that it has actually become an agenda of at least some sectors of the scientific community. And I think it's that that is really the nexus of the problems that we are seeing between science and religion.
So much to discuss there. Potent examples of beliefs and belief systems coming head to head over what evidence we base our beliefs on. On ABC Radio National, across the globe, on Radio Australia and your pod, this is All in the Mind. Natasha Mitchell, coming from the Australian Science Festival in Canberra, debating the nature of belief with theologian, filmmaker and Uniting Church minister Dr. David Millikan, a cognitive scientist who specialises in false beliefs, Professor Max Coltheart, and well-known science writer Margaret Wertheim, who lives in the USA, where battles about faith and reason are particularly contentious.
One of the reasons why I think that religious people have had to actually go down the intelligent design route is because the epistemological power of science has become so strong in our society, at least large sections of it, that if you want to claim that something is real, you have to use the language of science. And if you don't use the language of science, it's said to be an illusion or a delusion. And I think that is a huge philosophical problem for our society as a whole. That's why you also get the New Age movements making claims about all of the paranormal phenomena that a lot of New Agers want to claim. They use the rhetoric of science like it's happening in the fifth dimension or the sixth dimension or it's happening through string theory.
There's that
or
film,
it's
What the Bleep Do We Know?
Exactly.
Exactly. I mean, you...
Next time I hear quantum in the mouth of the New Age movement, I'm going to sort of vomit.
Margaret, no one say that word here tonight. You've even gone as far as to say that the Western world is in a psychological crisis because, in a sense, we've unsevered the strong connection that there was between the immaterial imaginings that we had once, a sort of soul space, as you describe it, and our material world. That's an extraordinary thing, really, to say for a science writer.
I think the Western world, with the rise of modern science, we believe that the totality of reality is the physical, material world. And pretty much every culture on Earth, except the modern West, has, in addition to its physicalist conception of the world, also has, as it were, other realms of being, other parts of reality. And so the West has been in this sort of psychological crisis, I think, of trying to have a way of legitimately discuss not just what falls under the banner of religious or spirituality, but I would say even psychological phenomena. And it was interesting that this problem was understood early on, that in the early 18th century, John Locke made the statement that it wasn't stable for a society to have only a science of body, and that eventually we would have to have a science of mind. And many people, I think, are crying out for some sort of language to talk about a human self. And so they're inventing all these kind of languages to try to deal with this problem that have been completely pushed out.
Which, in a sense, we've always done. We've invented languages to describe our state of being for millennia, perhaps. Well, Max, what about you? Because you are dabbling in the life of the mind every day in your work and in your thinking as a cognitive scientist.
Yes, you need to have a vocabulary for talking about mental events. And that it was really Freud that helped us there, because he was the first person to consider unconscious mental processes. And it turns out that nearly everything in our mental life is unconscious. It's very hard to figure out what consciousness is for, since we can do so many things with unconscious thinking. And we need that kind of terminology to talk about mental processes. But I think this is rather different from whether there's a material world and an immaterial world. Mm. So my job is the science of mind, but I think I'm working on the material world. I wonder what Margaret would say about that.
Well, of course, cognitive neuroscientists and cognitive science in general are now very much working on trying to understand the neurophysiological basis of mental processes and hopefully ultimately the neurological correlates of consciousness, as Christoph Koch has called it. But I think many people feel that there is, as it were, some aspect of humanness that isn't reducible to neurophysiological processes, which doesn't necessarily mean to say they're suggesting that he exists independently of the body. But
because that's getting back to Descartes, isn't it? That sort of split between the mind and the body,
yeah.
Which didn't really reconcile the two in the way that we're wanting to today.
Mm. I mean, you can say that there is a thing called the self, and I don't believe in God anymore, so I don't consider myself to be a religious person, but I do make the claim that myself is a fundamental part of reality and not an epiphenomena of neurological processes.
Max, I mean, you've just said that you're dealing with the material domain when you're investigating, in your case, the extraordinary false beliefs that people have, delusional beliefs, that you're dabbling in the material domain to deconstruct the nature of those beliefs.
A useful distinction here is when you're thinking about computers between the program and the machine. So you can have a particular program that will do something like word processing. So there's one level of description of what's going on, which is that word processing is going on, and you can describe that by a flow chart pointing about what's happening. And another way of describing what's going on is what's going on in the microchips. And I think that's the way of thinking about the relationship between mind and brain. They just, you can give a mental description of what's going on in mentalese, or you can give a physical description of what's going on, but you're describing the same event at two different levels. It's the same level of reality described in two different ways.
What do you think of the arguments that are emerging now that we are, as humans, with the big exotic brains that we have, that we are hardwired to believe? We are believers because evolutionarily wise, that's been an adaptive thing for us. To believe is to survive.
Yes, I think that's absolutely right. So whenever we study people with delusions, let me give you an example of two people we studied who had the belief that when they looked in the mirror, it wasn't them, but some stranger. You can quiz these people and you can say, well, if that's not you there, why is the person always wearing the same clothes as you? Why, when you move, what does that person always move? This is good evidence that it's actually you in the mirror, but these people won't give that up. The source of the belief in the first place was these people have a form of brain damage that stops them understanding how mirrors work. It's called mirror agnosia. And so when you're looking in this mirror, it doesn't seem like a mirror anymore. It seems like a window. And if it is a window, then anybody you're seeing there can't be you because they're in a different part of space. So the two people we studied had a second problem to do with belief evaluation. They couldn't be persuaded by evidence that this feeling that it was somebody else there was wrong. That's a purely mental process, forming the belief that it isn't you but some stranger.
And you're trying to apply this idea across a whole range of delusions that you work with. I mean, you're working with people, for example, who think they're dead.
Yes.
Or that their wife or their husband is an imposter.
Yes.
Or that a limb that is very much there and theirs is not theirs. Yeah.
So Cotard delusion is the delusion that you're dead, and you can talk to these people and they'll say they're dead. So you say, well, do you feel hot and cold? Do you feel your bladder's full when you want to go to the toilet? Things like that. This is all meant to persuade them to say, oh, I must be alive after all. But what the person said to me was, that just shows that dead people can feel whether their bladder's full or not.
Oh, gosh.
That was game, set and match for the patient.
The most extraordinary false beliefs.
Yes, that's right.
This seems to be sort of key to this discussion today. We can say they're pathological, but we can also say, well, they carry meaning in the world of these people. Just because beliefs don't stack up against demonstrable facts, does that mean that they're meaningless in our subjective worlds?
Well, this thread of the discussion came from your question about whether we've evolved to be believers. I think we've evolved to be explainers. So if something weird happens to us, we can't just say, oh, something weird happened. We have to invent an explanation. And you can see why, in evolutionary terms, that might have been important. And so if the thing that happens to you is really weird because it's caused by brain damage, there is no plausible explanation for it, but you've got to try and find an explanation. So when I wonder who that person is in the mirror, I've got to adopt the belief that it's not me. Otherwise, I've just got an experience that has no explanation. And I don't think we can tolerate experiences that don't have explanations.
David, Freud contested that religion was a sort of mass delusion. Marx called it the opiate of the masses. Yep. These are sort of great thinkers and their takes on religious belief.
Yes.
I know you've been sort of itching to respond to some of these efforts to reconcile faith and reason, for example.
Well, they demand each other. Look, I saw a sign on a church notice board. There it is in big letters, reason is faith's greatest enemy. I look at this and I think, good grief, what is happening? I'm now worried about what's happening inside that church. Because one of the characteristics of an aberrant new religious movement is a movement that robs its members of all mystery, which remove from people the capacity to question, to doubt and to reason. In fact, all fundamentalist groups fear reason, because reason provides an independent access and scrutiny of what the group believes.
How do you initiate a rational discussion with yourself? I'm interested in the way that you reconcile a faith in God. I'm interested in how you reconcile your faith in God with also a real commitment in your life to reason and rational thought.
Well, there's no choice, really. I mean, I've got to be able to say to myself at the end of the day, the most rational thing I can do is believe in Jesus Christ as my saviour. So it's got to be.
What's your test? Do you need a test? I mean, this is an interesting question. Do you need a test?
You must submit all of your beliefs to the scrutiny of reason. I believe that faith, in a sense, is reason testing itself. That we, as rational beings, survey the cosmos for things, possible things that we admire or respect or perhaps might want to believe in. And we move towards these objects and our rational processes are working flat out. We're saying, does this make sense? Is there a type of interior coherency about these beliefs? Do they contradict each other? That's the first test. Does it make sense in terms of the way it applies to me as a person? There's a whole series of tests you bring to bear, and as you start to zero in and your reason begins to, in a sense, heighten your confidence that the object of your observation is a worthy object for you, then you get into this dance between faith and reason.
I think a way to think about this is to ask the question, is it ever wise to adopt a belief even when it's not true? And the answer to that has got to be yes, because the beliefs you might adopt might be very good for your own mental health, for society. Let's suppose that one consequence of believing in a God was that you treated other people better than you would normally. Often not the case, but if it did, then that clearly would be beneficial for society.
But what's the point in believing something that's not true? It's palpably not true.
It might make you happy.
Well, what a desperate situation to be in.
Then it also raises the issue, who gets to decide what's true? Right. And usually, one of the things about religious beliefs versus scientific beliefs is that both are making claims to say that our side has got the lock on ultimate truth, and that's the very contestation. What constitutes evidence? What constitutes even the grounds for saying I've got proof?
Well, look, can I thank the panel? Professor Max Coltheart, Scientific Director at the Macquarie Centre for Cognitive Science at Macquarie University, filmmaker and minister with the DY Parish of the Uniting Church and a theologian, Dr. David Millikan, and science writer and commentator Margaret Wertheim, author of Pythagoras' Trousers and the Pearly Gates of Cyberspace, and joining us all the way from her home now in LA. Really appreciate you being here. Thank you. Give yourselves a hand. Well, so many cans of worms open there, hey what? The nature of belief. And you can pick up the discussion online because there's a special treat, along with the excerpt you've heard on today's show, which you should know is always available as downloadable audio and a transcript on the web. We've put up the full unedited debate and audience questions as downloadable audio as well. It'll stay up for 4 weeks or so. Enjoy. You'll find this and more at abc.net.au/rn/allinthemind. Email us your thoughts there too. We love reading them. My thanks to the crew, Pauline Newman, Angus Kingston, Lila Shunar and to Jen Parsonage. I'm Natasha Mitchell, back with you next week for All in the Mind, and if you're in Oz, enjoy the rest of National Science Week. Check out more at abc.net.au/science for things to do.
ABC Radio National. More than 60 programs, more than 260 transmitters Australia-wide. And we're live on the net as well as media on demand streams. Find out how to get more out of Radio National. Go to abc.net.au/rn. And for the full list of MP3 and podcast programs, abc.net.au/rn/podcast.